Jeanette Winterson writes criticism, essays, screenplays, children's books, and fiction, including the award-winning novel Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, which she adapted into a popular BBC television series. Her latest book, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, is a memoir that begins with her childhood in industrial England, where she was adopted into a Pentecostal evangelist family. The story she tells deals with identity and art and the intersections of the two. Jeanette Winterson was on our show in March, and we're replaying that interview for you now. I began by asking why she refers to her adoptive mother as Mrs. Winterson, never using her first name.
Well, her first name was Constance, which rather suits her because it's formal, and she was formal. But she thought of herself as Mrs. Winterson, and also Mummy and Mum and Ma, they have rather cuddly connotations, none of which would have applied to Mrs. W.
Could you have written this book if she was still alive?
No, and I wouldn't. But she died in 1990, so a lot of time has passed.
But wasn't Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit a kind of fictionalized version of the story you tell here? And she...
Yes.
Could have read that.
She did read that. She said when she read it, it's the first time I've had to order a book in a false name. And she was horrified. And she said, but it's not true. And if it's a fiction, why have you used your own name? And I tried to explain about metafiction and the imagination, but she wasn't having any of that. So we fought over what literature was for, always.
Well, how long after she died did you begin to think about her influence on your life and your writing?
Oh, I didn't wait till she was dead. I mean, she was the huge influence on it all. I mean, books were forbidden in our house, but we lived in a world of print because Mrs. Winston was a pamphleteer by temperament, and she used to stick exhortations all around the walls. Under my coat peg, it said, "Think of God, not the dog." And over the
under your coat peg, that means when you took your coat off,
yeah,
you saw that little
I
sign.
Saw that, yeah. And man shall not live by bread alone, over the oven. So that's how we lived. It was always language. She was in charge of language, and she read the Bible to us out loud every day, starting at Genesis, ending in Revelation. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Mrs. Winston.
Well, she got you interested in words, but you were a secret reader, weren't you? What happened when she found out that you were reading Jane Austen?
She didn't find out about Jane Austen, but she did discover that I was hiding books under my bed. She found out about D.H. Lawrence, which was very scary. If you have a single bed standard size and a collection of paperback standard size, you can fit 72 per layer under the mattress, which is what I did. Of course, my bed was rising visibly. Mrs. Winston discovered these, found them, threw them into the backyard, poured the kerosene heater over them and set them on fire. It was a shock.
She was horrified that D.H. Lawrence would be part of your reading material.
Yeah, but I was in the library after that. I realised that I could go to a real library, built with Carnegie money, actually, which had English literature in prose, A to Z, and I just started at A, and her last name was Austin. Good choice.
In a Paris Review interview, you said that your relationship with your adoptive mother was operatic, Wagnerian, and tempestuous. Was that mostly because of her personality, or were the two of you kind of operatic, Wagnerian, and tempestuous?
Well, families are a chemical reaction, aren't they? We were close together in a, it was like a test tube, our little house, and we were in there. And she was a very unhappy woman and a very rigid woman. And I was a happy child. I don't know why, given that I was locked in the coal hole and locked out. But I had an optimistic temperament, and she found that very difficult. She was waiting for the apocalypse. She lived in end time.
Well, if her vision of the world was so dire, why did she adopt?
She wanted a child to be a missionary, and she believed that initially that God had led her to this orphanage, but afterwards she was very bitter, and she always said to me, "The devil led us to the wrong crib."
That was you.
That was me.
She had also had a difficult childhood, hadn't she?
She had, and you know, you begin to understand your parents later and have compassion for them. She wasn't parented well, she wasn't looked after, she wasn't carried or picked up.
Well, when people tell me that when they write fiction, they often create a difficult character, and somewhere along the line, they have to humanize the character because otherwise they can't live with it, but also because nobody's going to believe that a person is just bad or difficult or whatever. And I suspect that's what's happened with you through two books.
She wasn't just bad and difficult, but I do call her a monster. But then I say, but she was my monster. You do try and love your family members, however difficult and impossible they are. It seems to be hardwired in us, and I did try. And she has all the best lines. She's like a Shakespearean villain.
Where was your father in all of this?
Silent or at work. He worked on the night shift and Mrs. Winson was in charge of everything. My father could hardly read. He hadn't been educated at all, left school at 12. And he handed over his whole life to her and he certainly didn't fight for me. He was a good man, but he was completely inadequate within the family setup.
Had she always been an evangelical or is this something she came to later in her life?
They came to it later. They'd been married for 12 years before a gospel tent came. It's one of those crusading Pentecostal tents and they found the Lord, and thereafter their lives changed, and of course it gave them a shape, as it does for many people.
Well, England already has a number of established religions. Was the evangelical movement big in the north?
By no means. It was small. But as you know, the Evangelical Pentecostal Church is the fastest growing church in the world at present. And it's great for deprived small communities where you have no hope, because it offers you hope. You know, it gives you something to live for. Mrs. Winterson had nothing to live for.
She also kept a gun, you say. Wasn't that illegal in England?
Yes, but not in the war, of course. And this was a service revolver. Both of my parents had been young during the Second World War. My father was in the forces. He'd been in the D-Day landings. I'm not sure whose revolver it was or where she got it from, possibly her brother, who was in the Air Force. But she kept it in a duster drawer and she kept the bullets in a tin of polish. And when things got bad, she'd place the gun on the table and sometimes she'd get the tin of polish out. We were always convinced we were going to be murdered. You know, the living in end time was not just waiting for the apocalypse. It was waiting to be shot by Mrs. Winterson.
My guest is Jeanette Winterson. Her latest book is a memoir called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. It is published by Grove Press. As a kid, you went to church with your family. And in fact, you say that for workers, especially the principle of religion remains good.
It does. You need a shape, you need a structure to your life. And then and now, people's lives feel as though they're out of control, as though there's nothing but work and emptiness. What are you going to do with that? You have to fill it up somewhere. And so it did have genuine properties for psychic health.
But in your case, didn't the church members actually put you through a horrible exorcism?
Yes, they did. They were following their beliefs. And of course, one of the rules for that kind of fundamentalism is not just no sex, but certainly no sex with your own sex. So when it was discovered that I'd been sleeping with another girl, they decided I had to be demon-possessed. There was no other explanation. So they did a 3-day, 3-night exorcism, which include the elders praying over me in shifts. And you can go in feeling pretty sane, but you'll come out being absolutely crazy. There's no choice.
How old were you when this happened?
The first time I was 14.
So when did you realize that you were gay?
I don't think I ever have realized. You see, I hate labels. All my life I've been trying to rip off the labels. And, you know, it's such a bore. I mean, the least interesting thing about a person is the gender of who they're sleeping with. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we lived in a more fluid world where nobody ever asked that question?
But some people become aware, others don't.
Yeah.
Or it occurs to them later in their lives. Some people never work it out.
Some people never work it out. That's true. That's their tragedy. I think I never foregrounded it. You know, I simply loved where I could. That was what was interesting to me. It wasn't the wrapper. It was what was inside the wrapper.
And how did your mother and the members of the church discover that you were sleeping with this girl at 14?
Oh, my mother was a paid-up member of her private secret service, and she was always wandering around the house with a flashlight. It was like something out of Edgar Allan Poe, our house, even though it was tiny. Disturbances and terrible goings-on. A girl stayed over one time, and Mrs. Winston came in. We weren't doing anything, actually. We were fast asleep in the same bed, but she was suspicious-minded, and that was enough for her.
And then she confronted you with it, what did
you
say?
Yes, she confronted me in the church. It happened but completely by surprise, and I was pulled out of the congregation by the pastor and the elders. Terrifying, and held up as an example of the demon.
So then you said, yes, I have been...
Yes, because I wouldn't lie. There was no point. And also, love is not something that you should feel you have to hide or lie about. That is what would corrode the spirit, not the act itself.
So at the same time, the church was putting you through all of these tortures. It was having an effect on you as a writer, wasn't it? Weren't your first writing sermons?
Oh, yes. I was brought in there to save souls and to be a missionary and to go around preaching the gospel. I mean, Mrs. Winston got what she wanted. You know, here we are. But it's for me, it's the power of art. And I learned early to use language through the agency of the scriptures. And indeed, that way of writing and thinking has stayed with me. That's short, strong sentences, something that conveys the meaning quickly but poetically.
So if somebody was really clever and went through your writing, they would see religious writing, they'd see the Bible in your work, even though you're not writing anything that has anything to do with the Bible?
Certainly. They wouldn't even have to be clever. It's really obvious.
Then you left home, but you left home fairly young, didn't you?
I left at 16, yes. That was another incident because I hadn't been able to give up the girl because I loved her. And Mrs. Winterson gave me the option. She said, either you leave home or you give up the girl. Well, what would you do? So I packed my bag and I went.
And then you applied to Oxford.
Yes, I lived in a car for a while in a little Mini, which I managed to do quite successfully. And then a teacher took me in because she was sorry for me. And I carried on doing my exams and applied to Oxford University and got in. That was marvellous.
And studied literature?
Yes. And that changed everything.
Were you able to read all those books without anybody telling you it was a bad idea?
I couldn't believe it. And when there was a knock on my door, I used to hide the book. It was such a reflex action. And I think, no, this is what I'm here to do.
No book burnings at Oxford.
No.
Some years after you left home, you reconnected with your first love. What was it like to see her after all those years?
Dreadful. She'd become smug and bovine and hypocritical, and as people do when they make the wrong choices, which is not the choice for me, but it's a choice for being true to yourself. And it was an early lesson in how important it is to be true to yourself and not to give in to the pressures around you, however difficult.
Now, why did you decide to write a memoir? Hadn't you handled much of the story to your satisfaction in Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit?
I thought so. Oranges is a cover version. I mean, it's based on, it's not as is. But
well, it's a semi-autobiography.
Yeah, it is. It uses facts from my own life. But when I was trying to search for my biological mother after finding a series of unexpected bits of paper after my father died, I was keeping close notes about that journey, and that set me back to thinking about Winterson World, and I wanted to revisit that material. So the book really wrote itself. It was not a project that I planned. It came from internal pressure, and it was actually written very quickly. I'd done 15,000 words in 2 weeks, and that tells you that something's going on.
But you are writing in this book about some very painful experiences.
Mm.
Is it when you're writing, does it become technical? So the dredging up all of these painful experiences doesn't hurt as much, or were you experiencing them in great pain all over again?
It wasn't great pain. No, it was cathartic in that I was glad to write this and also glad to have some Archimedean point outside of the self, finally, on which to reflect on it. You know, there was enough distance, and that was very precious because Oranges was written when I was 25, and this was written 25 years later, and that changes things.
Well, you've learned a lot about writing.
Yeah, I have.
But did you? And you probably learned a lot about writing also from doing other things, like writing the TV version of Oranges.
I've written everything. I mean, I think of myself as running a little workshop. If you want a chair or a table, I can do it for you.
Now, you say that you hope that your biological mother would read Oranges and then come looking for you, but that didn't happen?
No, but that's because I had the wrong set of paperwork to start with. It turns out Mrs. Winterson had the offer of another child beforehand, so the original documents were not mine at all. And so my natural mother could never find me because the clues I'd left were not for her. And in the end, I was the one who had to find her, and it was difficult and traumatic.
And how did you finally meet her?
Oh, I met her through a series of legal endeavours with social workers. It took over a year. Finally found where she was, went up there, felt physically sick. It's a terrible thing when you meet your biological mother. And I knocked on the door and she opened it. Sub-zero temperature, snowing. She had a great pile of washing in her arms. And she said, I just thought I'd get this on the line before you came. She's marvellous. It's the kind of thing I'd say. And we both laughed. And then that made the meeting possible.
So did it turn out to be as important to your life after as you'd imagined?
Yes, it was hugely settling. And it's not to do with the kind of relationship you establish thereafter. That continues to be tricky and difficult, you know. It's not a DNA connection. You haven't seen this woman for 50 years. But for both of us, it felt like there was a question we no longer had to keep asking to ourselves or in our dreams. It was very hard to have that separation and wonder, who is my mother? Who is my daughter? And I sent her the DVD of Oranges as a kind of, you know, this is what happened while you were out. But it upset her. She was disturbed by Winterson World.
Well, it seems like all of this is a move toward improvement. And then you had a breakdown in 2007.
Well, the breakdown was all within the process of finding the paperwork. I didn't find my mother until I was well and healthy and sorted out again. I couldn't have faced that, I don't think. But it was triggered by the paperwork and realising that there was this thing that I call the lost loss. It was a huge loss, but it was so hidden, I didn't even know it was there. But it was infecting my whole life.
Now, the title is something Ms. Winderson asked you, why be happy when you could be normal?
Yes.
Does it have to be that kind of trade-off?
No, it's one of those false questions, like, you know, why can't we afford healthcare? You know, we can. If we stop affording wars, we can afford healthcare fine. Happy, normal, normal, happy. You know, they're not binary oppositions. But she was a violent philosopher, and yet it was a good question for me to leave home with.
Mm-hmm. And it's the one that you grapple with in this memoir.
I do, and I still do. You know, sometimes you have to step outside the norms of society to find who you are. It doesn't necessarily make you happy, but you have to do it.
Back to fiction now?
Definitely.
And do you think that in writing a memoir, you learn something about writing fiction?
Yes, you learn about how to infuse yourself more clearly and cleanly into the narrative. You know, there's no such thing as a separated experience. You know, we're the totality of what we are, real and imagined.
Well, the I takes on a different kind of significance in first person. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.